as you meditate with the attention turned inward to the source of the sense of I. Give permission to the physical vehicle to relax and let go of any stress, any tension, any tightness. Bring the awareness to that point from which there is the realization that one is consciousness. Pure, simple presence. Without thought. And enter the silence of the self. The stillness and feel the heart opening in love for the source of your being, for the source of consciousness, of life, source of the inner light. And feel how that love for the real Supreme Self brings the attention into communion into oneness with the Supreme Presence. And as the attention is absorbed into that supreme power of life and light, feel how its energy emanates into all your vehicles, subtle and physical. And empowers the intelligence, the heart, the will, and the body abide in that stillness that is the channel of power. Until it is realized as your own. Egoless power. And feel that power also as love, as bliss, as light, as eternal presence. And let it charge the batteries of consciousness until there is fullness, luminosity, infinite expansion, all-encompassing, all-pervading energy. And be in that complete union with the Absolute, and know that you are that uncreated, eternal, limitless. Free of fear and desire, free of thoughts and images, free of any agitation, in an ocean of joyous power, in which all is recognized as the one infinite creative intelligence. Let the ego dissolve forever in that infinity. Shiva. Parameshvaraya. Parashakti. Buddha, Cristo, Tao, Shivaya, Shiva, Nama, Om, Shivaham, Aham, Aham. Namaste. The Jews celebrated their Yom Kippur recently, the Day of Atonement. Atonement is an interesting word. Three levels, depending on how you split it up and pronounce it. The lowest level is atonement, and that's the level for the ego that feels remorse for its sins, and spends the day fasting and asking forgiveness reciting a number of prayers to that effect. But what is the real sin to atone for? Isn't it falling away from God itself? And isn't that what the ego is? But can the ego atone for being an ego? It can't ever get to that level. It can atone for the minor sins that the ego does, or even major ones in a relative fashion, but it can't get rid of the fact that it is the source of those, let's say, episodes of bad karma. It can't change it. It doesn't have that power, and so that's why there's prayer to God, because one feels helpless in the commission of or omission of accurate behavior and commission of inaccurate. So there's a higher level, which is that of attunement, but the attunement must come at the soul level. Only the soul can attune to God. The ego can pray and can beg for mercy and can do particular acts of austerities for limited periods, but it can't eliminate its paranoia, its aggressivity, its greed, its lust, its fear, its anxiety. It has no power to let those go. So they remain, and they are the cause of further reasons to have to atone again the next year, but it doesn't really accomplish elevation. Whereas attunement to the vibrational frequency of God, that will bring elevation of consciousness to the level that you are resonating with. If you can reach the vibrational frequency of the Supreme Self, if you can do that, then you'll rise to the top level of at-one-ment. That's the nature of the self. That's non-duality. The self is the oneness of all that is. There is no second, no other. And it is that realization that everything is the one consciousness and a manifestation of the one intelligence that is functioning as a multiplicity, but the underlying agency is not within the matrix of the multiplicity. It's actually the dreamer of that dream, that power that is present but hidden, at least hidden to the ego, and only glimpsed by the soul, but that is in fact everywhere and everything and all that could possibly be, whether in the subtle realms and the dimensions that do not appear, as well as in that which appears and disappears. So the state we want to be in is at one-ment. The lower two are only, interim measures that we use to try to get to the true nature of our being. But we are already that at one-ment. We don't really need to get there. It's an illusion that we're the ego. So the atonement actually affirms the illusion, because then you believe you are the sinner that must atone. But that is the illusion that must be given up, you see? And that illusion is the source of the jouissance, the enjoyment of sin and suffering and the illusion that the consciousness has become addicted to. And because of that addiction, has lost its free will to rise into its higher levels of its own real nature. And because the ego is obsessed with the petty concerns and the manipulations of its local space situation, and it wants control and power, and it wants everything to work out the way it wants, or it's frustrated and angry and upset, and it's always in emotional volatility, it's never at peace internally. And because it's not at peace, it can't meditate, and it can't get out of the situation that it itself is causing by its emotional reactions and projections and introjections that are disturbing it. But it can't get out of it because it doesn't have a margin of peace from which to say, no more, I'm done. And one has to reach that point where one is literally done with the ego. It is of no further use, and there must be a conscious realization. It's obsolete, it doesn't serve, it's a waste of your time, and it's not intelligent enough to know how to navigate life without creating more pain and suffering for itself and for others. So this is, right now, I would say, an urgent necessity to get out of that lowest level, which can be very self-righteous. The people who go to the synagogue and atone, I'm sure, feel very good about themselves, especially if they paid a lot of money for their seat and, you know, all of that, which apparently, you know, has gone up as an inflation of spiritual absolution in the world. So the situation is that that self-righteousness keeps one feeling like one is where one should be in the lowest level. But at that lowest level, of course, those sins, the demonic nature of the shadow that infiltrates into the ego and influences it to commit more sins and crimes and misdemeanors and all of that, is in charge of one's consciousness. One has given up one's power, one's real power, to those impulses and drives and intentions of an agency that is not oneself. And so there's a foreign thought form functioning as the usurper of your body, your mind, your emotions, and running your life. And it's that that has to be removed. That's the virus that has to be eliminated. And if we don't do that, we're going down the drain very quickly, because that virus is now literally creating a pandemic, not the one that's talked about out there, but the one that's causing the one that's talked about out there, and that has turned the world into a war zone in which there's already mass death, although it's not reported very accurately in the mainstream news. But it's happening. And if people knew what was really happening and the media told the truth, people would be horrified, aghast that this could possibly be happening. But they don't want to believe it, and they want to think, oh no, everything is okay. And so they continue in that herd mentality and do what they're told, whether by their rabbis or priests or pope or mullahs or whoever they're following who has been co-opted by the system, and probably not going to meet a very happy end in terms of where this world is headed and one's own life in the hands of those powers that do not mean one good and elevation, need to be recognized for what they are, and we need our minds awakened and illumined to be able to cope with the situation that we're facing in a way that will serve not the ego, but serve the real self, serve God, serve the power of goodness to bring the world back into a higher state. So because of the urgency of that, and because I couldn't find any good movies for you to watch, I have usurped your Saturday night again with more meditation and conversation about the urgency of reaching self-realization. And I also want to emphasize the ease of doing it, the fact that it's not difficult. Everyone thinks it's too difficult, it's too hard. That's the ego deceiving you. That's how that satanic force that you think is your own mind is controlling you. So it'll either tell you it's too hard, or you're not really interested, or you don't know what this guy is talking about, or everything is okay, or where is that movie? Let's go back to the internet as soon as we can, and whatever. But the ego is going to keep you from having a real a drive for liberation from it. And if you are identified with it, you are literally a lost soul. And so the only way to get free is to silence the mind, because that's how it controls you. It hypnotizes you. It creates a thought in your mind, and you believe it, and you believe it's your own thought, and you act on it. Or you get upset by it, or it creates an emotional situation that gets somatized and suddenly you're sick or you can't function or whatever else. But the ego is controlling you at a mental level and a physical level. If you don't realize that, you're not going to have even a margin of will to try to defeat the demon. You're going to assume, oh, it's just me, and I'm weak, and I'm helpless, and I'm not smart enough, and I've got other things to do. This is not high on my priority list, etc., etc. So until you've overcome that delusion, you won't be able to figure out who you are. But it's very important to realize all of the sages who broke through, who got out of the matrix, who got to the real Zion, according to that film's version of it, but the real liberation, they all say the same thing. That you are already not in the matrix, but you believe you are. You believe you're your body. You believe you're your mind. None of that is true. But you're not going to know it until you've silenced the mind and realized pure consciousness. And the realization of pure consciousness is the realization that you are formless, timeless, and non-local, and that you are nowhere and everywhere, but that your consciousness is free, and that it has far more power than you imagine, and that your ego will let you know about. So that's the message. Claim your power because you have it. You are the dreamer of this cosmic dream, not just a victim of it. And if you are willing to do the experiment, make the shift into silence long enough to break free of the I thought, you will be able to realize the Supreme Self. I was looking at movies to show you, and I noticed that Hollywood has created so many movies about the end of the world. And they were back in the 70s and 80s already making horror films about a virus that would kill the whole population. And really, I found several of them that I was even going to show you, but what's the point of showing you? It's really happening now. Why do we want to increase your paranoia? You know it. But the fact that this was already there, whether you call it predictive programming or some intuitive wavelength that the creative script writers were able to tune into, or just the fact that the deep state was telling Hollywood what to do to prepare the population to accept all of this. Nonetheless, it's all out there in the collective consciousness. This is nothing new. This is nothing unpredictable. It's something that was prepared for and planned and produced by forces that are beyond any local, national boundaries. And if we don't understand what these forces are that we're dealing with and where we stand in relation to them, and which forces we can receive power and help from, we will not be able to be able to withstand the pressures and the terrors that are shown very very graphically in those films. And the way out is jnana and bhakti. Those are the two weapons that we have. If we use those weapons, we will be victorious over the warden of our consciousness, the ego, superego, dyad, that keep us in the chains of the illusions of the matrix. So, I want to read a couple of passages of jnana and bhakti. This, by the way, was all known a long time ago. There was a German philosopher back during Hitler's time, Karl Jaspers, who wrote a number of very excellent books. I think some of you have maybe read. I've recommended his books to people here. But he created the concept called the Axial Age. In the early part of Kali Yuga, of a 700-year period from about, he lists it from about 800 BC to about 100. I would include it all the way to 100 AD and start at 700 BC. But in this period, you have you have Socrates and Plato and Pythagoras, and you have the last of the ancient Egyptians who pass on their wisdom. You have the Vedas, the early shamans, and the first yogis, and the teachings that will become the Upanishads and the Advaita Vedanta and all of that. You have Buddha in that period. You have Xuanzi and Lao Tzu and the whole Taoist wisdom schools and the I Ching. And you have a huge worldwide arising of wisdom that is suited for the coming yuga. And he called it the Axial Age, as an axis. I will like to refer to it as the front axle of Kali Yuga, the front axle age. And I would say there's a rear axle that happened in another 700-year period, which was from about 900 AD to 1500 AD. And in that period, also throughout all of Eurasia, you had the Italian Renaissance, you had the Spanish Golden Age until the Spanish Inquisition, of course, around 1492. That was the cutoff point. And the Italian Renaissance was also cut off by the church and around that time. And had to go underground, but you had the Kabbalah, and you had many new wisdom schools arising in the East. I forgot to mention in the front axle period, you also had Zarathustra and the whole Zoroastrian and Mithraic traditions. So all of that was prior to what I would call the final wisdom school, which was the one created, or at least developed by John the Baptist and then by Jesus. And it was a Jewish wisdom school for a long time, and then it became a hybrid, and then the Roman Empire severed the two. And they became antagonistic, the Jewish and the Christian. But they were one wisdom school for over two centuries. And you had the other wisdom schools in China that were growing up. Well, you had the same thing in this period in the East, in the, around 800, 900, 1,000, all the way up. And you can say in the Muslim world, it was Ibn Arabi and a number of other sages, Rumi in Persia. And you had in India a whole number of incredible sages arise who gave birth to the tantric traditions. The Spanda school, the Pratyabhijna school, the Trika school. There were many different wisdom schools, many of them in Kashmir. And in southern India, you had the Virashaiva wisdom school. And you had the Shaiva Siddhanta. You had a number of different schools that took off and created a renaissance in India. Later on, the Vaishnavas took off with that whole tradition. And Ramanuja and Madhva and various other neo-Vedantic wisdom schools who were formed by those sages. You also had, of course, a tremendous amount of interactivity between all of these schools that produced hybrids, and tantric Buddhism came out of the Hindu tantrism and developed all of these incredible Buddhist schools in Tibet that went on to China. And of course, you had the Zen tradition that was then flourishing and moving to Japan with Dogen Zenji, etc. So it was a worldwide spiritual renaissance that was cut off by the forces of the collective ego and the empires of the time as well. But we are still living off of the texts that were left behind by those wisdom schools, and the few surviving sages who went underground and used the information symbolically in a coded form to be able to transmit them into the future. And now they are available and being found in the same way the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, the Dunhuang Caves was found with all of its incredible texts of Tibetan Zen and the other other tantric traditions that had been lost, and texts that had never been translated have in the last 20, 30 years been finally translated with amazing depth of wisdom that had never been known before. So if we avail ourselves of that wisdom, we will be able to take off from the ego very easily. But we have to understand the richness of this knowledge that is available to us and churn it in our consciousness and turn it into the amrita that will produce the power and the liberation from the egoic consciousness. So one of the sages during that period of the rear axle was one of the early, let's say, founding fathers of Kashmir Shaivite tradition that became later the Pratyabhijna, or the recognition school that we're going to be studying actually in this coming retreat. He was a figure who was an incredible, Utpaladeva is his name, he was an incredible sage, but he was also, much like Rumi, totally insane with love. He was in a state of absolute devotion to Shiva. And he was famous for going out in a rowboat in the middle of Dal Lake, a huge lake in Kashmir, every morning before sunrise with a few of his disciples. And he would sing. He would download information and insights that they would write down in the rowboat as it was shaking, as he was standing up and singing to the sun, and he was in this trance state, but he was emitting this wisdom, and they were writing it down, and it has been saved and kept, and gradually was organized differently and put into a form of several books, but one of them was a long poem called the Shiva Stotravali, and this has been translated recently. This isn't really a great translation. There's a better one by Swami Lakshmanju, but I'm going to use this one because it's much easier to deal with. He gives a commentary on every line, and it's very, very unwieldy to try to quote from. And he will tell you what devotion really is, parabhakti, what it really is, because it's not just a matter of singing kirtan or, you know, doing rituals or chanting prayers and mantras and all of that, but it has to do with the attunement, the real resonance with God consciousness. But first I want to read a line from Sri Ramana. He was visited by two Parsi ladies. Parsis were the Zoroastrians in India. You know, they're still there. Imagine, Zarathustra has followers now. How many? From like 900, some say he was at 9,000 BC. No one knows exactly when Zarathustra was, but he was one of the earliest of the prophets. And that school is still going on, and they're called Parsis from Persia, because they had to leave Persia because of persecution and went to India. So one of these women asks Ramana, "I understand that the self is beyond the ego, but my knowledge is theoretical and not practical. How shall I gain practical realization of the self?" Okay, that's everyone's question, right? So here, what does Ramana say? Realization is nothing to be got afresh, okay? You can't get it. You can't buy it at the feria, right? It's not a product. It's not something that you are not, okay? It is already there, as Ramana says. All that is necessary is to be rid of the thought, "I have not realized." That's all. You have a thought that I haven't realized God, that I'm separate from God, that I'm this body, I'm this ego. Get rid of that thought and all of the contaminating thoughts that go with it, and it's done. Okay, and then this woman who takes it the wrong way says, "Well, then one need not attempt it," right? And Ramana says, "No, but no. Stillness of mind or inner peace is realization. There is no moment when the self is not. But the self is in superposition. This is my words, not Ramana's. Superposition with the ego. And because you're identified with the ego, you're not recognizing that it's the self that is giving the ego the sense of reality. Because the ego, all it is words in the mind. It has no reality. It's an imagination. There's no reality to it except that the words are given life energy by the real self that's present at the same time but isn't recognized. That's why the recognition school in Kashmir that Utpala Deva founded is so important. He says the same thing. You don't need to find God. You have to recognize that you are that. That's all. Okay, so Ramana says, so long as there is doubt or the feeling of non-realization, then attempt must be made to rid oneself of these thoughts. Okay, so that's all we're doing in meditation. We're getting rid of the thoughts that are cluttering the mind so we can experience or imperience consciousness as it really is, not obscured by the thoughts that then project yourself into a reverie, into an imaginary state of images and feelings about people and projections, and you're suddenly in an imaginary world where you're being attacked or you're being slighted and insulted or you're being whatever. You're in some scenario, and usually with people in the past who are not even in your life now. You're living in an imaginary bubble. You're not in the present. You silence the mind and realize what the present really is, what consciousness really is, and then life changes because now you will enter the intelligence of the self. So, the thoughts are due to identification of the self with the non-self. When the non-self disappears, the self alone remains. To make room anywhere, it is enough that things are removed from there, right? If you want to say, well, I need more space, you remove the clutter. The room is not brought in from afresh. It's already there. And then Ramana says, no, even more. The room is there even in the cramping, even while there's clutter in the space. The space is there. Okay, if you'd focus on the space and not what is cluttering it, if you'd focus on your consciousness and not the thoughts that are cluttering it, you would already be realized. And then Ramana goes on, absence of thoughts does not mean a blank. It doesn't mean you space out. It doesn't mean that you go into, you know, some laya state, some state in which you're not there, you're blacked out or something. No. When there must be one to know the blank. Knowledge and ignorance are of the mind. They are born of duality. But the self is beyond knowledge and ignorance. It is light itself. It really is light. There is light in the mind, palpable, actual light, divine light. And it's that light that gets projected, and you see the lights here that are created by the phenomenal dream field, but the dream itself is created by the inner light. Okay, so there is no necessity to see the self with another self. There are not two selves. What is not self is non-self, and therefore the non-self cannot see the self. The self has no sight or hearing. It lies beyond these. The self is all alone as pure consciousness. So the self, it does not have an object, unlike the ego that always wants to hear and see and know what's going on. There's nothing going on. There is timeless presence in which the world is there as a dream, but it has no reality. It has no effect upon the self, which is transcendent of the dream and all alone. It's that aloneness that is also the at-one-ment. And if you're willing to get past the ego's fear of loneliness and abandonment, you'll stop cluttering the mind with thoughts that give you the illusion that you're not alone because voices are talking to you. and you will realize that aloneness, and that will take you to the supreme alone, all oneness of God consciousness. So, this is an important point that Ramana makes next. There is a being, there is a consciousness, an intelligence that is aware of the ego and of its thoughts. That isn't the ego, that is the self, okay? That's what you have to understand. The self is also an ego, but it's the supreme ego. It's the supreme I am. That's what God calls himself in the Bible, right? I am. Aham, aham. That is the truth. If you will understand that I, not the I of thought and of identification with matter, then you are free. So, Ramana says, that ego is pure ego once it is purged of thoughts. It is the same as the self. But so long as false identification persists, doubts will persist, questions will arise, and there'll be no end of them. Doubts will cease only when the non-self is put an end to. This will result in realization of the self. There will remain no other there to doubt or to ask anything. All these doubts must be resolved within oneself, but no amount of words will satisfy. Hold on to the thinker. Hold on to the awareness that is conscious of everything that arises without identifying with what arises, and you'll extract yourself into that pure consciousness that will then have the power to stop the arising of the mental chatter. But only when the thinker is not held onto in meditation do the objects appear outside and doubts arise in the mind. Okay? So it's very simple. That's all it takes, is silencing the ego clutter, and you will realize the self. If you hold on to that awareness of the ego, you will become cognizant at some point that what you are is pure, intelligent consciousness that has no anchor in the body. And then you will be able to download all of the latent powers of the self. Okay, so in a way, that's the difference between the front axle and the rear axle age. The front axle age, the yogis were teaching pure liberation. Get out of the matrix. Realize that you are unborn and that your consciousness is transcendent. And non-duality is the way it is. By the time of the rear axle age, consciousness had become too identified, too dense, too materialistic to be able to simply liberate itself. That's why Ramana talks to these people and they don't get liberated, even though he just told you how simple it is to do it. But will you do it? Very few will actually accomplish it. So in the period in which yoga morphed into tantra, A new form of sage arose. In the first axle age, you had the Jivan Muktas. You had the beings who went directly to at-one-ment. And you had, on the other hand, the egos who had some level of devotion, but had no power. And you had a third kind of, let's say, investigator of the paranormal levels of consciousness, who were shamans. The shamans had a kind of knowledge that was still within the ego, but could deal with altered states of consciousness in which they became aware of ghosts and of demons and of angels and of beings of interdimensional nature and of the vibrational field in which we all inhabit, and were able to make use of those energies and forces to bring about healings, but could also put curses on people and could also do many other things with that level of power that were not always good. So you had a kind of black magic that was arising in that period. And the same thing was happening in Europe. You had a lot of magic that was not the alchemical white magic, but was black magic that was happening, which continues, of course, and is even more technologically developed now. But the yogis of India during that period used the shamanic knowledge and created a new hybrid, which what the Tantra enabled one to develop, of the shamanic knowledge and the supreme knowledge. And those beings who became liberated but remained enough within the phenomenal plane to make use of those powers on a practical level were called siddhas. And so yoga for many became the acquisition of siddhis, of powers, the latent powers of consciousness. And the yogis of the more classical age warned them against this. Don't do it, because if you do black magic, there'll be a karmic backlash, and it's not worth it, and don't get trapped and caught, because you won't get liberated. That's true. But the siddhas found a way to be liberated but still have the power. That, I think, is the legacy that we must understand and make use of today. But we can only do it if we have purified ourselves of ego and our capacity of action that is non-egoic and pure goodness, not for any nefarious purposes, uses that power of will and of non-local intelligence to be able to achieve things within the phenomenal plane, via the noosphere and the morphogenic capacities of consciousness to make changes that are in the service of that supreme power. So, Utpaladeva was a siddha, and we're going to be studying the works of the Kashmiri siddhas in this upcoming retreat. And Mahasiddhas. Those are the ones who are completely liberated and still use the power. The siddhas are on the edge. They're more like in a bodhisattva state. So I want to read one of these poems that was written down by Utpaladeva's devotees. This is from the first one called, well, again, it's a translation, The Pleasure of Devotion. The word was not pleasure, it was really bliss of devotion. So that's why this translation I will at some points modify, having read enough of the original to recognize some of the failings here. She starts out, "We praise." The word is actually "I praise." This is Utpaladeva talking. "I praise the one who is filled with devotion, who meditates not, nor recites any of the prayers, or follows the rules, and yet, without any effort at all, attains the splendor of Shiva." Okay? So the one who is a true devotee does not have to meditate. Okay? If you have to meditate, you are not in attunement with God, and you're not going to get there. You're going to waste your time in meditation, and all you'll do is have a passive blank state at best, or a chattering state, or you'll fall asleep, or you'll be in some other state that has nothing to do with union with God. I'm sure you all know that from experience. So he's saying, You don't need to worry about following rules. Don't worry about that. In non-duality, there's no rules. There's no good and evil. But you have to be filled with devotion. So now he's going to talk about what does that mean to be filled with devotion? Okay. Though my soul is young, drinking the nectar of your devotion, I think he means not young but eternal, drinking the nectar of your devotion. And remember, he's saying your devotion. It's God's devotion, not his own. He's drinking the nectar of God's devotion. My body is as one gone gray, with hair whitened by the dust along this journey through the world. Even the path of worldly living becomes blissful for real devotees who have obtained your blessing, O Lord, and who live inside your realm. Okay? Are you living in Shiva Loka rather than in the phenomenal egoic hell realm? When everything in the world is your form, how could there be a place not suitable for devotees? Where in the world does their mantra fail to bear fruit? All right? If you know the mantra and it is empowered by your devotion, which means your connection to God, no matter where you are, you will have those magical powers. These are siddhis he's talking about. You don't need to be in an ashram. You don't need to be anywhere special. Those powers will be with you wherever you are. You don't need to go on any pilgrimage or find anyone to give it to you. It's there within the devotion itself. Triumphant are they, intoxicated with the celestial amrita of devotion. They are beyond duality and yet retain you, Shiva, as the other. So, to be in non-duality and yet to keep God just enough as another so that there's a current of energy that flows between you, a spark. It's like creating a spark plug. And that spark can go off just with the word Shiva. As soon as you remember it, the power of the devotion hits like lightning. And you can keep that lightning constantly flashing through that devotion of remembrance and recognition that Shiva is yourself. So he goes on, only those who are immersed in the joy of fervent devotion know the essence, O Lord, of your boundless ocean of bliss. So do you have that fervent devotion? You see, it's that movement of your heart, that the thrill of love and of the joy of the power of receiving the Shakti that will keep the current flowing, will charge the battery, and will be turned into applications of a practical nature that will be the siddhis that you will be able to use once you're totally immersed in the ocean of bliss. You alone, O Lord, are the self of all, and everyone naturally loves his own self. Thus, victorious becomes the one who knows that devotion is inherent in all. So you already love yourself. The problem is you love your ego self. You love the thought, which is a representation of yourself. It's not your real self. Try loving your real self that is inconceivable to you, that you don't really know because you stop with thoughts. And then you will know what devotion is. Okay. Lord, when the objective world has dissolved through the state of that deep union, you stand alone. And who does not see you then? But even in the state of normal consciousness, of differentiation of subject and object, between the knower and the known, you are easily seen by the devotees. So the devotee doesn't have to meditate because the devotee sees Shiva in everyone and therefore is always in that state of love and joy and union. God is everything, everyone, everywhere. When you know that and are devoted to receiving the power through whatever and whoever you're with, not stopping with the superficial level, the devotional energy flows. Just as Devi, the goddess, your most beloved, the endless pool of bliss, is inseparable from you, so may your devotion alone be inseparable from me. Okay? So devotion is the goddess. It's that pure love. Love is the goddess. And that pure love and devotion brings the bliss of the union with the self that you are devoted to, who is inseparable. And then he makes this very interesting remark. The path of the senses is threefold, marked by pleasure, pain, and delusion. For the devotee, this is the path that leads to attainment. Okay? Don't try to get out of pleasure, pain, and delusion. No, but realize God in the delusion itself. Because the delusion is also ultimately created by God. Even the ego is created by God, even though it's an obscuration of the presence of God and becomes a test of your intelligence and your devotion to break through it. Nonetheless, it's still part of that same intelligence because there's nothing else. And so don't be frustrated by your lack of pleasure or your obsession with pleasure or your frustration and your delusion and the pain of the ego, because that's the path. If you'll realize God is present in your pain, you will be free. You'll realize it's a divine blessing. The highest state of intellectual knowledge has none of the taste of the nectar of your devotion. To me, O Lord, it's like sour wine, right? So if you're just going to study like a scholar or want to know this stuff intellectually to impress people, there's nothing there. If without devotion, even if you have perfect understanding of quantum physics and metaphysics and everything else, you're empty. You will have no benefit from it. And you won't get out of the matrix. So only those who practice the exalted science of your devotion, it's a science, are the only ones who truly know the essence of knowledge and ignorance alike. Okay? Because even ignorance is God. And if you can pierce through into the nature of ignorance, you will understand it as a symbolic, dreamlike, hidden jewel that wants to be recognized as a manifestation of the Supreme Presence. And then he says, may this vine of speech, a vine that creeps up a wall, it's that kind of a vine, this vine of speech rising steadily from the root, everywhere adorned with blossoms and sprinkled with the nectar of devotion, yield for me fruit abundant with that feeling, that devotion. Right? So the vine of speech, it's a very interesting metaphor. In the Kashmiri Shaivite tradition, speech has four levels. So the vine has four blossoms on it. The speech of the mouth, the speech that can be heard, that is audible to others, is the lowest level of speech. I think that's called the vaikari. And then you have the second level of speech, which is your subvocal speech, the mental chatter that is going on. That's the madhyama. And then above that is the paschanti speech. This is the speech that gets an aha, a download, an insight, an inspiration. And it's just turning it into words, but it's in an archetypal form. It's not yet fully transmissible into thought and language. But it comes as an intuition, a knowing that is not yet thinking. And then above that, you have the para, the supreme level of speech. That's the level that Ramana is always calling the ceaseless eloquence. That's the language of God. It's totally silent and can't be heard unless you're in at-one-ment. And that's the absolute knowledge of the real that transcends time and space and yet pervades it all and is absolutely an ocean of blissful knowledge. That speech can be heard by one who has pure devotion. That's what satyogis should be devoted to, hearing and being able to turn into not only speech, but power. And then you will know the mantras that bring the magic spells that will change the world. May you gain that power through the purity of your heart's devotion to the source of your own being. Here and now. Namaste.
Namaste.
We have a little time left if anyone has any questions or comments. I didn't finish the poem. I'll go into it more next time. But I think you can see Utpala Deva's incredible intellectual and heart development. Anyone have anything you want to bring to the table? There's one, Kalyan.
Thank you. In your, well, at the highest level of speech, mm-hmm. when you mentioned downloading or hearing that calling, that
that's
word.
The second level.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood, because then I was thinking that sounds more like attunement.
Yeah, that's the second level.
Because when you're at one-ment, what's there to hear? You are that, right?
That's right, you are that. It's still, the language is there, but it's a total knowledge that transcends time and space. So it's not happening in time. It's not happening to the individual you. That one doesn't exist, really. It's the real I that is speaking to itself. Aham, aham.
Okay. Thank you. I really appreciated this explanation.
Okay. Thank you, Kalyan. Uh-huh.
Thank you. That was very beautiful and empowering. There's two questions I have, actually. One is from the poem. When you read the part about keeping Shiva as another, as the other, mm-hmm. and in remembrance, can you mm-hmm. explain that more? Because it sounds like duality, but you're reading non-duality. So,
remember, non-duality includes duality. It's the non-duality of duality and non-duality that is that ultimate state.
What's the practicality of that?
It's realizing the nature of love itself in its purity that has no object. But the love itself creates the other. It gives birth to beauty. It gives birth to everything. And so the source of that everything one has love for, the creator of the world, the creator and destroyer and recreator, that ultimate power. How can you not love that power? And that power is yourself, but whatever part of you is within the matrix is still other than that. As long as there is that other, there must be devotion. And that devotion, of course, then heals the illusion of the otherness, but you still keep it because the lightning bolts of bliss are so nice. Why would you want to just, you know, transcend and lose that? That happened to Ramakrishna. Remember, he said, I don't want to be God. I want to have the devotion for the goddess, for Kali, and receive her love and joy. If I just become that, then I lose. Not really, but it is so beautiful and creates such illumination in the world for others that it's a service to stay as a devotee.
It is so beautiful. Thank you. I wanted to ask also about the siddhas and what kind of powers would be useful in this moment in time to help the world, to bring magic to the world.
I think healing power of every kind and the power of fearlessness, the power to understand the mind of God, to see that everything is a blessing and not to be afraid and to project negativity into the world. But also, because, you know, quantum physics shows there's entanglement everywhere, you are able to have effects non-locally and in a secret way that you cannot affect through words or through trying to convince somebody of something, but you can reach them internally if you have that power that can illuminate them, even though they may have ego defenses against knowing something. It can be dropped off into their consciousness using the morphogenic or virtual reality level of this matrix. And if you know how to navigate that, you can have effects of helping lots of beings who are struggling and who need that lightning bolt, that vajra, to awaken them.
So in essence, it's vibrationally. I think in the Gyana video yesterday, you said something about kind of knowing how to modulate your vibrational frequency. Mm-hmm. Sure. Is that the equivalent of siddhis?
Yeah, it's a sea of vibrations. But you have to be the field that contains the vibrations in order to be able to have the power to modulate them. If you're identified with one of those vibrational currents, then you don't have the power. So you want to be able to dissolve into the field, that's liberation, and then bring into the field whatever is useful. Mm-hmm. There's one. Kin.
Oh, thank you, Shunya, for this stirring satsang. It was really beautiful. And when you were reciting the poem, I could feel this devotion welling up. And so it's a lovely experience, and it's something that I tend to forget very often. And I just go back to a sort of intellectual, mental state. But it's so wonderful to be reminded again of just the ease and the relaxation of that devotion. And I had a question about that too. When you were speaking, I'm not going to ask a question yet, but when you were speaking of Utpala Deva, whom the poem was from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then you spoke of the sage on the boat that was...
That's him.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Reminded me of Ramakrishna, who would also go into trances and start singing. And
Yes.
Which is very inspiring reading that. It's one of the books here. I think that my question, aside from just gratitude... is sometimes I will feel this devotion or I will feel love coming up, and it's exciting and there is a thrill to it, but there's also a fear that comes with it of, oh, it's going to erupt something, or oh, it's going to overtake, or oh, something's going to happen. And so perhaps it's something with the superego coming up.
Yeah, the fear is ego, superego, and the one that wants to go up is the soul. And so you're in that struggle.
Yeah.
And so you have to side with the soul and don't have fear. That's a deception.
And just sort of detach from that thought as soon as it comes up, because it is a thought, right?
That's right.
Okay.
It's a thought that comes with an emotion, with fear. And if you give in to the fear, then, of course, you're lost. You won't rise into that higher state. So you have to be courageous enough to cut the connection to the thought and the fear and keep going. And then you'll feel the bliss.
Haji, thank you. And yeah, thanks again. It was a beautiful evening.
Thank you. Anyone else before we adjourn? Lakshmi?
You've mentioned several times tonight this word morphogenic. And it's a word you made up.
Well, it exists, but I gave it a different meaning.
Can you explain a little more about the morphogenic field? How, because you said you have to bring or be in, you know, draw from the morphogenic field in order to bring it to this plane. And the morphogenetic is then on this plane, right?
Correct.
And one of the essays that we're reading for
yes,
our next.
Right. Wasn't that the ego in the noetic field? How many have read that essay? So, okay, I don't have to start from scratch. So the phenomenal plane has two levels, to start with. I'm going to simplify things, but there are two levels. We can call one the actual level and the other the virtual level. Okay? On the actual level, you have a morphogenetic field. At the virtual level, you have what I'm calling the morphogenic field. Okay? So at the virtual level, this is the noosphere. We are connected. We are entangled. At the actual level, we're separate. And unless you have telepathy, you don't know what someone else is thinking and all of that, right? And we're all in our separate ego bubbles. But at the virtual level, no. There is a single net of consciousness, that a network, you could say, that you can tune into, and that is unlimited in its expanse in terms of space, at least at a planetary level. And it has access to higher levels of virtuality than the one that is simply in resonance with the actual, right? But these two are the level that everyone is operating on all the time. You're on the virtual level when you're thinking, right? To some extent, you're downloading bits from the collective noosphere. If you can master that level, you will be able to effect changes and have influence on beings who are not spatially connected to you and on those who are spatially connected but aren't open to what you might want to tell them at the actual level, but who will be able to feel the download of information that you are sending them from the virtual level if you are thinking about them in a certain way. This is what black magicians use to put curses on people and that kind of thing. But it can also be done for very benign purposes. Okay, so you can use that level of your consciousness to have an effect on the material plane. Okay, and it has no limits in terms of space to where it reaches. In the same way that the electromagnetic spectrum can go around the world, this is a higher level of vibrational frequency than that part of the spectrum. And once you are, once you have reached a level of greater coherence than the collective, then that coherence becomes a value. It becomes a priceless power that people will want. So they'll want to absorb the information that you're sending out if it's better information than what they've got within. Then they'll tune into it. They will attune without knowing they're attuning at first, but they will attune in order to stay able to retain the frame of reference that you have downloaded that enable them to see things that otherwise they weren't able to conceive were happening. They would have been invisible if you were in a reality tunnel in which you were not allowed to see it, right? You could see with the injection. There are a lot of people who can't see that it's causing harm and what it's actually doing and what it's for and all of that. But you get them out of that reality tunnel and then suddenly, oh my God, right? So there is work happening on the morphogenic regarding that and regarding everything that's happening, as well as on the morphogenetic, where it can be censored, right? You can be deplatformed, but they can't do that at this virtual level. So this is where the power is to have effects that can't be blocked by the powers that rule the actual, but do not rule the virtual. Okay.
So would you say that the morphogenic is the fourth level of speech that you want?
No, it's third.
Third.
Yeah.
The archetypal.
Yeah, because you want to go beyond even the virtual. Where does the virtual get it? See, it's still a part of the creation. But it's the mind level rather than the matter level. But both mind and matter are within the matrix. So you want to go beyond that. That highest level then can have an effect on the entirety of virtual and actual. But that's a higher and harder level to get to and to make use of. But you can very easily at a soul level make use of the virtual level. And also learn from the noosphere So then you don't need to go through, you know, listening and watching all the videos. You get it instantly and save a lot of time surfing the internet, and you understand, you know, what is happening within the actual paradigm and this level of the matrix that is moving in ways that are hidden to the masses, because there are surprises that are part of the war games that are going on. But if you understand the virtual, you can see ahead and prepare. So forewarned is forearmed, right? We're forearmed in many ways as gods and goddesses, but we have this ability to have preparedness via the knowledge that we can receive and transmit. Okay.
Can I ask, just to understand well, the difference with morphogenetic, because the first time I heard it was when you mentioned it many years ago, with this population of, was it monkeys mm-hmm. in some island,
right.
where some learned a particular skill and yeah. the rest just learned it completely
yeah.
Without
right.
even seeing the other
right.
ones do it. It was just kind of...
Well, first they did see it. It was first passed at the actual level,
okay.
and then it moved to the virtual when a certain number of them reached that. But that's a slower process. If you start from the virtual, it's much faster, and then you affect it much more widely and quickly. And you can go beyond the behavioral level. Right? Because this is about ways that you can behave more accurately. But what if it's about just the thinking and the use of consciousness at a higher level that is not able to be spread, because it has nothing to do with your individual level of being. It has to do with the level of cosmic being of which you are one node, but that you are part of this larger self. At that level of consciousness, then you have a much more powerful effect.
But you just said, just the last question. You said in what you shared in the teaching that you have to connect to that level so that you can bring it to this one, right?
Right.
In speech. That would be one way, but it can also be energetic.
Just energetic.
Just energetic.
Yeah. Yeah, mental transmission of not only information, but of power. Because that's what people are lacking, willpower. You know, they know what they should do, mm-hmm. but they don't have the power to do it. They can't just quite get up and do the thing, leave the situation that is aversive, you know, get out and be safe. So if you are stuck in habitual tendencies and have no willpower to break into another paradigm of being, then your knowledge won't help you. So it's actually willpower that is the real, let's say, prize that you can offer that won't be refused, because everybody wants that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that has to come from an even higher level, okay,
mm-hmm.
the real power. So, but we are there, and the more that we realize we are one with that one we're devoted to, the more the power of that communion is able to be downloaded and transmitted. Okay?
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. So it's not an either-or between the morphogenetic and the morphogenic. The virtual and the actual are always in resonance. You want to be working in both and in those two higher levels that were mentioned of speech, of knowledge, so that all of the levels of reality are coherent and cogent and unified. And that's when the whole dream will shift. Okay?
And devotion, would you say, devotion takes you there? Or
yeah,
is,
yeah
is
devotion to God, yes.
It's the channel that will propel you to that level?
Mm-hmm. Devotion and knowledge, right? Right. Ramana just said, stop your thoughts and you'll be there. You don't even need devotion.
Mm-hmm.
But devotion will make it easier because we're beings who want to love, and if we love that source, that energy will connect us. Okay. So I recommend using jnana and bhakti, not one or the other. Okay? In that case, we will adjourn. Thank you all for your tolerance and your willingness to forego the cinema in order to get out of sin and to realize the truth of our the real movie that we're all in, and that we all have the power to transform. Namaste. Namaste.